Happy birthday, little Eva, born today in 1945. Young woman. That's Locomotion made her famous, hit number one back in the day, and we had a little Eva Locomotion to get ourselves started here with some Locomotion about the city and what's happening around us with our guest, Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Associate Professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, co-editor of Blackberries and Red Bones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair Body Politics in Africana Communities, Catalina Bird, Media Consultant, Political Strategist, co-host of No Hooks for the Hip Hop Chronicles here on WEAA, and Dr. Richard Vatz, Professor of Rhetoric and Communication at Towson University's Department of Instructional Leadership and Professional Development, author of the only authentic book on persuasion.
Must you laugh every time you mention the title of my book?
That's such a funny title, the only authentic book.
But there's a history, man. I won't get into it, but I'm just saying.
Don't. 410-319-8888 is in our brain. I'm sorry, you know I love you, Vatz.
I do. But the fact you have to keep reminding me of that says something about me, whether you don't.
Okay, so here we go. But on a very serious note, before we start, I want to take a step back for a moment. Because just the other day, we lost somebody who was a dear friend of mine, who I used to do theater with and act in the 80s. We did so much work together. She became president of Towson University, Marvin Lushky, and she was an amazing human being and leader of that university, probably one of the best leaders that the university has ever had. And you, as on the Senate, you're in the faculty Senate, right?
I am.
And also had that same feeling about her. And just before we go to the heart of our conversation, just your thoughts on Marvin Lushky.
Marvin Lushky was the colleague I have admired most in my 40 years plus at Towson University. I have never seen an administrator who changed the paradigm of the university presidency to include overseeing the student body, interacting throughout the campus. She also attended the faculty and staff while representing us aggressively within the University of Maryland system. Her combination of integrity, competence, and strength was unique, and I suspect that no one will ever equal her. I wrote an article last year saying that I thought she was the best president that I had ever seen, not only here but anywhere. As great presidents do, she surrounded herself with people whose honesty and love for Towson almost equal hers. Tim Chandler, the interim president, Maggie Wright's the interim provost, and she also had a kind of unofficial support group that included Ruth Drucker, Tom Casella, Nancy Grasmick, who was the first presidential scholar that she ever had at Towson. She was unique. She wasn't just a good president; she was a great person and a great president. I've never met anybody like her in my career.
And I know she worked up in the last moment that she could and had to resign because the cancer was just getting to her. In such a profound way that she couldn't continue on, and she wanted to continue on, but couldn't. So I know the family. I know her husband, and
yes, Dick Gillespie,
a wonderful human being.
Yes.
And so our hearts go out to all of them, and condolences to the family and to all of us for losing this incredible woman in the midst of our community.
It's very difficult.
I'm glad that you were here today, so at least could give some remembrances of her.
Thank you for the going through that. Thank you.
So let's begin to where we are. Folks, we're open here, 410-319-8888. And I don't know, so many places to start here locally. Where do we begin? I when I watch the vast differences between Governor Hogan and Mayor Stephanie Williams Blake, between Republicans and Democrats, around things like the red line, around things like whether or not the stores that were burnt out during the uprising, that the mayor and others in the city not wanting to have new liquor stores being rebuilt and having those stores be something else, and the Governor Hogan saying something very different, so supporting the liquor store owners and reconstituting the liquor board itself, the red line being shut off and shut down after $288 million is spent without any plan about what to do instead of that. But let's just shutting it down. So what are our thoughts about this politics of the moment? Because it's deeper than just the politics, I think.
Well,
Kat, why don't you start?
The red line was flawed all along. There were many people who were against it before Governor Hogan took office. And so what he said, and people choose to not pay attention to, is he's going to, at a later time, just not this past week, say things in reference to what the plan is for Baltimore and improving its transportation and its infrastructure. And I think that we should wait. We should wait and hear what the plan is instead of assuming to know.
Except that I would push back on that because, I mean, it's clear that and I know the Red Line had a lot of flaws in it. But from the beginning, he and others were opposed to it before the flaws happened, before they switched things around and created this kind of project that had the flaws that it did have. He has a new man he brought in who hates rail as the new Secretary of Transportation and wants highways. And we've seen now that Baltimore suburban area has the fourth worst traffic in the United States of America. There is a serious problem, and in terms of, and I grant that the Red Line running parallel to the subway and all the other madness with it, there was a lot of things that were wrong with it. But the question, there's no idea or plan about what comes next, and it seems to me at this point there could have been some outline for people to wrestle with, since he's so clear about why it should be shut down, plus taking money away from the Purple Line and putting it on the backs of Prince George's County and Montgomery County.
Well, the governor in his campaign was against both the Red Line and the Purple Line.
Yep.
And I think that he made a judgment about the cost and benefit. That is, I'm not an expert on these matters, but it seems to be reasonable. And also, you can always tell whether a decision is reasonable when you look at some of the reluctant testimony of the opposition party. Ike Leggett, the Montgomery County executive, let me quote what he said. He said, "The governor's process had no hint of politics or partisanship whatsoever. I think you have to give him very much credit that he was willing, open, and ready to listen, and his transportation secretary was open and willing to be a partner." And I think that that the fact that he has Democrats who support his decision and his reconsideration of the Purple Line, I think shows that he is making a reasonable decision. And the Red Line is a tremendously costly program, and the kicker he indicates was the billion-dollar tunnel that would have had to support it in the heart of the city. It seems to me to be a perfectly reasonable decision that he's made.
And it may be perfectly reasonable, but I wonder if it's what it says politically, because I think the division between the governor and the mayor for a while now seems to be exacerbated by a move like this. And because we don't have the definitive plan that is to come forward, it at least gives the appearance to the rest of us who aren't inside and know the inner workings of what's happening. It gives the appearance that there is further division between these two political leaders.
I think that's something that's hyped up and then fueled by the media, ourselves being included. Because when you make a pragmatic decision, it doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat, you're looking at the budget that you have, you're looking at what the cost-benefit analysis of a project is, and that's not something what I credit the governor for, and I think that we all refuse to look at it in that lens because, ooh, he's the evil Republican. He hasn't played politics in any of his decisions when it came to the budget, when it came to the things that he campaigned on. It's about specifically what it takes to change Maryland. It wasn't a political move to lower the tolls. It was a move for Marylanders and things that he said he was going to do. And I think that we need to be more cautious in the way we frame it instead of making it always Larry against Stephanie, and more so about the governor's leading, and that's what we elected him to do.
Well, he's leading in a certain direction, and you may not agree with that direction, or you may agree with that direction. I'm sorry, you're going to say what?
No, I was just going to follow up and say I agree with you that the media does play a part of lighting this fire, but some of that it has been realized for us in some of the decision making that has taken place, especially the backlash against public schools in this city and what that has done. I mean, that easily creates not only a division between mayor and governor, but certainly with voters in Baltimore City or citizens in general in Baltimore City and how they look upon. In this case, for me, it's just the governor. But I know for a number of people, it's about politics, that it's a Republican governor instead.
410-319-8888, your thoughts. And I'm going to come to the question of the liquor board. I'm going to talk about the homeless encampment that was just destroyed here in Baltimore and talk about what's going on with the city police and more, and given all these reports coming out and who actually is leading who. We just don't know. 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Steiner.
Good morning.
Do you mind if I speak to the transportation issue?
I do not. Of course not.
You know, Mr. Steiner, the guy that designed the law library for the University of Baltimore on Charles Street, he made a comment that if an area urban doesn't have traffic jams, it's not worth living in. And it just took me aback when he said that. Okay.
Well, I guess we have a place worth living in then.
All places in Maryland are going to be worth living in by that criterion.
Downtown Baltimore, and anybody in transportation that doesn't understand this has no business being in transportation. That is the hub of the city. When you tie up traffic in downtown Baltimore City, it affects traffic all over the city as far as 5 or 6 miles away. So you have all of these parking garages downtown that are dumping traffic in downtown Baltimore at the same time. You have all the impediments. Everybody's running a bus down at University of Baltimore, University of Maryland, John Hopkins Hospital, valet parking on every major thoroughfare that you see down there, and it does nothing but tie up the traffic all over. Now, just consider this for a minute. If the city had taken and built a 1,000-car parking facility down there around where the casino is, coming right in off of the Beltway at $100 a month, and offered working people shuttle buses, which they would, a lot of them would gladly take it into the downtown area where they work, that they'd have collected, $100,000 a month of their own money, and it would have taken all of that, a lot of that traffic out of the downtown area.
Right.
You know, the red line would have, I can't even imagine in driving a cab what the red line would have done to Baltimore City in its construction. And that's one decision I can agree with the governor wholly. So if you don't do anything about those parking garages and the traffic coming in, working people
right.
coming into Baltimore City, you're not going to solve that problem at all.
Thank you. I mean, it's interesting. A friend of mine who used to be Vice President Rouse and who ran Mondawmin Mall and other places, Anthony Hawkins, had this idea years back. He said to alleviate the traffic conditions in Baltimore, there should be massive parking lots built all around the suburban areas around Baltimore with shuttle buses bringing people in to cut down the traffic and build a different kind of city that's pedestrian-friendly, bike-friendly, building a different kind of atmosphere, with still parking lots for people to drive in and go to dinner and do whatever they want to and come in if they have to go to the city, but in center city to really have to begin a different design. But that's something we don't think about how to change the nature of the city. I don't think anybody thinks creatively about how to change the nature of the city in very deep ways. But this weekend, they cleaned out the homeless encampment. Kimberly, let me get you back in here. Because I think that again, this is another issue that is intractable in the city. When you have 86,000 families who are home insecure, you have any given night 3,000 to 5,000 people on our streets who are homeless and experience homelessness in the city. And I was on the mayor's committee, whatever that thing was called, to look at homelessness, the 10-year plan they had. I quit because it was just blah, 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 with nothing really concrete happening. And I yawned and got tired and left. But I
so what came with the plan?
Well, still lots of homeless people.
And so there will always be.
I don't think there always has to be. No, because there were no homeless people before Ronald Reagan.
I didn't say there has to be.
Ronald Reagan created homelessness in America.
But don't take my quote and misquote me. I said so there will always be. I didn't say so there always have to be. I'm saying that there is a seminal problem in Baltimore City that touches on crime, touches on homelessness, and it's a problem that can be solved in 10, 20 years, and nobody ever wants to get into long-range solutions, and that is the structure of the family. And until we start disincenting single-parent families and fatherless homes, we'll have periods of peace, but we're always going to have these problems. But if we ever start solving this problem and changing the culture, not just Baltimore, but every place that incentivizes fatherlessness.
Oh, God, don't go there again. My
but
God.
But Mark,
it just drives me crazy. This is not the center of the problem of Baltimore City,
no,
Rick.
No, the center of the problem is affordable housing.
Yes,
and
that's
crazy. And the lack of access to it. A livable wage. I don't know what kind of Mike Huckabee moment you're having, Rick Vets, but that's not the case. What makes and creates homelessness is a lack of affordable housing, a lack of opportunity to jobs to be able to earn money to sustain housing. And then And also, you know, one of the gentlemen that was in the article that they quoted, Mr. Johnson, who was one of those that was displaced when they cleaned it out under MLK, said he felt safer there than he did in the shelters. And I've heard this account from numerous people who have been in the shelters. So it's not only do we have a lack of access to shelters and not enough shelters for all of the population that we're trying to serve, the shelters that we have aren't safe. And it says something when the shelter is so unsafe that someone feels safer sleeping on a major thoroughfare than they do inside of a shelter. Those are the things that we have to
address. And what else could we have done to address what was happening in that particular location instead of just uprooting individuals and dumping their things into dumpsters and saying, now go away, as though the problem goes away. The
and
problem doesn't go away.
They weren't impeding traffic. They weren't problematic. It was absolutely no reason to do that.
Well, the attractiveness of it was a problem.
And the history of homelessness in our society, I mean, all the studies have been very clear that before the money was taken away from subsidized housing under the Reagan administration, there was almost no homelessness in America save for some addicts and drunks and people who wanted to be on their own. This is a problem created by lack of government funding, by lack of affordability of housing, for people to be able to get housing and find housing. That's where it comes from. And I think that we don't want to wrestle with that. We don't want to figure out how to change that in the city, nor how to put people to work to make this thing to make it work.
Instead, we just want to get rid of it and pretend it doesn't exist. And so putting up the fence prevents them from congregating again and setting up temporary home locations. And so for the rest of us who are driving up and down MLK, it doesn't exist anymore. So we believe it's gone and the problem has been done away with. But the reality is it still exists and it perpetuates.
We do have freedom of speech on this station, right?
You do.
Okay. Let me state my position, okay? The reason that I've said, and I've said this before, and you've indicated your complete contempt for this point of view, fatherlessness has increased from the 60s to today among whites from 3% to 30%, among blacks from 24% to 73%. This touches everything. It touches the economy. It touches employment. It touches education. It touches everything, and everything is related to this. And all the solutions that come up for all of the problems, let me just make this point. All the solutions that come up for the problems have some incremental value. But until you solve this seminal cultural problem, you're going to have repeat and repeat and repeat of all the social pathologies that you have in Baltimore and everywhere that has this problem. And there's no way to deal without it. You cannot have a society based on a single parent formulation.
And I would just say, and then there's some other. Okay. So we can open the phones here, 410-319-8888. Leap in. We want to hear your thoughts. I mean, I think that, first of all, Ta-Nehisi Coates, Charles Blow, studies from the CDC, and other studies have just blown that entire idea out of the water, that it's not an absence of fathers. It's an absence of marriage, which is a big difference in absence of fathers.
Absolutely.
Right.
Right. Furthermore, it was not the people who incentivized fatherlessness. It is the Department of Social Services and the programs through which working class families got help that said that you couldn't get it unless you put the child's father on child
support, right,
and that they couldn't live in the home. So you have a number of people who have the fathers in the homes who have to say that they're not. So when you recite statistics.
Tiny point.
No, it's not. It's not at all, Rick.
It's a huge portion of it. So if you want to talk about incentivizing fatherlessness, how about we incentivize giving support to families without having to say that the father has to be removed?
Families as a whole. That's right.
And other studies have shown that what people call out of wedlock births, that the numbers have gone up for people of color in this country who have children when they're living with somebody and not married. The living with somebody is a critical piece here. People do. There was not one study shown. I'm trying to pull it up now that showed that the percentage of black fathers who are not married spend more time per hour with their child than a percentage of white fathers who are not married. And so this is a specious argument, Rick.
It's not
that
a
has to do with
argument.
Some moralistic,
it's
monotheistic
born, it's
bull.
It's born of, well, but you
that
see,
has no reality.
But you see,
you know,
but Mark, I think the reason you get angry is because I think there's no, you don't have the answer to it. And I think the answer to it, if you look
the
at
the answer to it is, the answer to it is jobs for people. The answer to it is decent housing.
The answer to it is your statistics make up a problem that doesn't exist.
Housing. Well,
so you don't need to make, you can't answer something that doesn't exist. It's like asking me to pull Puff the Magic Dragon out of my pocket.
Well, I don't want you to pull Puff the Magic Dragon out of your pocket. But if you look at the Moynihan Report in 1965.
Oh, God.
That's who we want to quote?
That's who we want to quote?
I'm saying,
go ahead.
I'm saying that predicted all of these social pathologies. And I'm telling you that you can get angry when people bring them up as much as you want, and that guarantees that you're never going
but
to
because people,
culturally solve these problems.
When you throw those stats out, Rick, the problem is you only read those stats. I've read all those stats too. You don't read all the other articles that have shown and all the studies that have shown that this is not the problem you're making it out to be. There is a problem with fathers not being in the lives of their children in the poorest neighbors in our community. That's a very real problem, and that people are trying to address. The vast majority of people who have children, fathers are involved in their kids' lives. They may not be married. I mean, you could put me in that statistic. You could put Catalina in that statistic. But we are both.
You are outliers.
We're not outliers.
No, they're not.
We're not outliers.
Not at all.
We're not outliers.
We're
very
that
common.
That your theory is flawed.
We got to take a quick break. Eric, I'm going to come to your phone call. We're going to tackle the police issues that are facing the city. Stay with us. 410-319-8888. Eric and Floyd, you're up next.
Hey, my name is the Pasta. Now I like to plug the real thing. So loose with the tap dance.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you all here with us. The Peace Parts of De La Soul from the album De La Soul Is Dead hit the charts today in 1991. We are here with Rick Vatz, Kimberly Moffitt, and Cat Bird, and you at 410-319-8888. Let's go right to the phones, and then I want to get into the question of what the issues of police in the city and liquor boards and more and where we all fall and what's happening with that. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Floyd. You've been on the air for a while. I'm holding on for a while. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Floyd.
Thanks for having me. I just want to make a brief comment observation that the people here are still being mistreated, and the ones who need the constructive help are not receiving it. The mayor pointed that out in the last call. When I was on your show, I mentioned how we only get 14 days a year where we can have overnight guests here in public housing in the senior
right.
And I try to get my grandkids to come over at least twice a month and spend the night. We spend the weekend, go to service, then come back and have dinner as a family. And that's what's needed. Black men have to try to be with their children and grandchildren more. And I think that would go a long way in making sure that we have a safe society. Thanks for my comment.
Thank you. 410-319-8888. Another caller in here, then we'll come back to the panel. Dex in Baltimore on the air.
Yeah, I wanted to comment on what the guy was saying about the fact that, you know, fathers not being in the home. I really do not see where that has anything to really do with the homelessness in Baltimore. I really think that, you know, we should have programs for not only the mothers, but also with fathers and encouraging them to, you know, be trained, get jobs, get housing, you know, so that they can, if not, you know, if they can't be with the mother, at least they can be in their child's life. You know what I'm saying? There needs to be some sort of form where the mothers and fathers should be get together and put aside their petty differences so that they can raise their children if they, you know, in between the homes and whatnot. And then all these houses that we have out here, 86,000 people don't have places to live. But when you walk up and down North Avenue, Drew Hill, McCullough Street, you just see rows and rows and rows of houses where there's nothing being done to the housing. They're just eyesores and whatnot. I mean, we need to get contractors into this city, somebody that's willing to build. You know what I mean? We're building up East Harbor and we're building up downtown. But the city where most of our people who help, you know, keep this city together and pay taxes, you know what I mean, there's nothing being done to it. You know what I mean? And then the other thing he said about the fathers not being in the home. When Glenn Denning was in office, he was doing no tolerance sweeps and all this other stuff. And when they had these sweeps, a lot of these fathers were being locked up on the corner, just visiting or just walking past and wrongfully incarcerated, sitting over the jail. So if you really want to know where some of these fathers are, they're somewhere on trumped up charges from the last two mayors or whatever. And now they're not in their children's lives. You know what I mean? And it's got to be some kind of way where we got to figure out some kind of form to put together to better the housing situation in Baltimore. It's a lot of lives at stake.
Dex, appreciate the call, and thank you for calling in. I think that the mass incarceration of poor black men and men of color in this country has a huge effect on families and their ability to be fathers and be around. And
what mother wants to take their child to a prison to visit that child's father? What part of you wants to do that in the essence for the purposes of keeping the father in your life? There's no part of you that wants to expose your child to that. So when you do mass incarceration and you take them from the home, you're only left with one of two options. He has to be absent until his time is served, or I have to emotionally and physically expose my child to something that will stay with them and be problematic for the rest of their lives.
Let me ask you a question. One of the things that's come up in the last few weeks here is what is happening since Freddie Gray's murder, since his death. The release of the autopsy report we just saw that wasn't complete. And how they got released was a question that people are wrestling with as well. But, you know, we've seen now that the gang threat that we read on this program after demonstrations began at Mondawmin, we read that from the police department. That was found to be completely uncorroborated and not real. And some of us kind of questioned that from the very beginning when it came out. Neither the mayor nor the commissioner knows who told the police to stand by and watch stores being burned down and not do anything at that moment. Who made the decision to both close the schools early and shut down the subways and bus routes so kids were stranded in the middle of Mondawmin in a confrontation with police. So none of these things are being in, nor is the police, but people calling a stand down, and officers we've had on this program have made it clear that they might not be calling it that, but officers are pulling back from really important work they're supposed to be doing. If they can't do it the way they want to do it, then it's not going to get done. They're afraid to go after a suspect. They're afraid to be charged themselves. All the dynamic is in there. So, you know, this is something that the city is a crisis, and we're not treating it. It just seems to me as a crisis. The mayor was only with us for a short time, and she wasn't in studio, so it was hard to kind of pull some of that out of her. I wanted to get to next time she's in studio. Hope we can do that. But our thoughts on that. I mean, what we are seeing here really is a crisis in policing and really is a crisis in our city, especially the poorer your neighborhood, the bigger a crisis it is.
I'll just tell you that I have friends in the police. I have also have friends in the Hogan administration, and I can tell you that I can't quote them, but I can tell you that they believe that the mayor and Anthony Batts gave an order to stand down, and they also believe they can't trust that Mosby or that the city has their backs. And I can tell you that they also believe that the mayor cares only about her own political future.
As not like most other politicians.
Well, that may be true.
You know?
That may be true. That may be true.
Batting 1,000 a day, right?
thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, right.
I didn't know Kevin was on my side.
I always thought it was a setup. If you recall, the day of Freddie's funeral, the family had asked for there to be no protest. There had been rallies consistently since the announcement of his death. And what you saw, if you weren't in the dynamic, was three things happened almost overlapping within the hour. This supposed credible threat came out against the police. This supposed call for all the kids to purge on Mondawmin Mall. And everyone who's anyone was sitting in New Shiloh in the funeral. So we were watching news cameras and police staging areas while all of the elected officials and the family members and other people were inside the church. No one had any planned protest that day because it was out of respect for the family. I think that in an attempt to scare people into asking the police to go back to policing in such a way, it backfired on them. And that's why they can't find the rhetoric now to clean it up. They led to that made-up threat led to the uprising that only lasted one particular day, when we're honest with ourselves. No lives were lost. And it's spiraled out of control, and they can't find the words to put it back together, because no one's saying go back to what you've done, go back to the way that you do it. If you're standing down, you can't figure out a way to do your job without harassing or harming someone, I don't want you in the force anyway. You aren't protecting and serving my neighbors. You are here to get a paycheck and bully people for whatever is frustrating you in your life, as far as I'm concerned, and you can kick rocks.
Yeah, I'm disappointed that no one seems to be willing to take responsibility. I mean, because I think that's part of choosing to lead a city, choosing to run a police department, that at some point in time, someone needs to be the person to step forward and say that this is an action that I called upon, so that we can deal with that piece and move on to what next needs to happen. I do believe, and I even understand, interestingly enough, the perspective that police officers feel like that no one has their back and that they're uncomfortable with doing their job. But I, too, agree that it's problematic that if you feel like the only way to do your job is to do it in such a way that it's bringing harm to its citizens, that, too, is problematic. And there has to be a happy medium somewhere in here where police officers are being supported and protected as well, but also being able to protect and serve its public without there being these competing realities.
Go ahead, then I'll open the phone.
Well, I think you're right. I think there's somewhat of a zero sum game here, and I think there's a real problem with the mayor's divided loyalties. I mean, when she won't even call people who have rioted and burned thugs, and when she thinks
I won't either.
Well, I what do you want me to say about that? I mean,
I won't either.
Yeah, well, that's good.
Because thug has become synonymous with another word in this country right now, and I won't use it for those kids and as other political reasons why I won't use it, and social reasons, and my sense of who they are.
But the mayor explained her reticence to use that term, not in the sense that it had some reflection on African Americans, but the fact that she thought that we should be a little bit more understanding of the rioters. And I'm telling you that when you take that position and when you immediately try to inculpate police officers, six of whom, in my, you know, from what I've read, there's a case against one, you know, I think that this is an unsolvable problem. You cannot find the police to be culpable presumptively, and you cannot refuse to
have
call.
You ever heard of Tyrone West? Have you ever heard
yes.
the name of Anthony Anderson? How do you take that position knowing that these six officers who got charged are just the first ones to ever be held accountable, but by far not the first ones to have ever taken someone's life?
Of what?
Unarmed.
Okay, you don't want me to answer?
People's lives.
Do you want me to tell me when you want me to answer?
I need you to justify that because it makes sense to you.
Ready?
Now.
Of what evidentiary value is what you just said? You said, look at Tyrone West. Why aren't people being held accountable? Ergo, these six must be indicated. Tell me why that makes sense.
That's not what I heard. But what I'm hearing is that we are also in a society in which all human beings need to be held accountable if there is an action that has been taken to harm another human being, regardless of the particular title that you happen to hold.
That's the basis. That's correct. But that does not justify a rush to judgment and a rush to indict.
But we've had arguments. I mean, you can argue that argument legally from attorneys that have argued in this show about whether that was a rush to judgment or not a rush to judgment, and they'll debate that out in the courts. And that is a political and legal discussion people have had. But I think that there's an overarching thing here that I'm going to open the phones is that we are seeing something take place here that is beyond the kind of state and city arguments that are taking place. We're seeing an intractable poverty among a huge portion of black citizenry in this state and in this city, with no jobs, no housing, no adequate housing, inadequate schools being closed down.
Businesses being closed down.
Liquor stores that supply stuff that the neighborhoods don't need in that quantity being shut down. No opportunities there. So a police force is there to ensure that property is protected over the rights of people, because you have a seething population that people want to keep their hand, that a foot has to be kept on. That's the problem. And until you kind of understand and until we admit that that is the problem, we're never going to begin to change what's happening. That you have a police force that doesn't really care about most of the people in those neighborhoods and that
if a mayor doesn't care about the businesses, go ahead.
Well, if you're talking about the business of liquor stores, I think that's
no. I'm talking about the fact that she delayed having the National Guard come in. Tell me how you could possibly justify that.
Well, I don't. First of all, I don't know about her delaying it. I mean, the National Guard came in within less than the day of when things began. So were you going to have them in as soon as the first rock is thrown? You're going to call the National Guard?
No, the governor was...
No, and what happened was the police did not do anything to stop the CVS from burning. They could have formed a line saying, we're not burning the CVS. That didn't happen. That didn't need the National Guard.
Plus, CVS has insurance.
Mark, with all due respect, and I mean with all due respect because I respect you, you only look at one side of all of these conflicts. You have no empathy for the unsafety that businesses go through, that people put their life savings into, that they lose, that the mayor won't have the police act, that she's unreachable. I mean, you really I'm not saying that your arguments are incorrect. I'm saying they're incomplete.
Do these businesses not have insurance like the CVS? Are they not able to rebuild?
You can't be serious.
I'm very serious.
You can't be serious that insurance for businesses makes up for a business being burned down.
They were. Oh, my goodness. Really? Seriously? Yes. The insurance allows you to rebuild. So whether it was burned down or not, you can be rebuilt with the funds from your insurance if you have insurance.
Let me go open the phones. I promise to get to the phones. Let's do this at 410-319-8888. Eric, you're on the air. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi. I've been listening to y'all. Well, first off, I just want to say, for a black man myself in the city, the police, to me, unless you've been dealing with them like I have in the past when I was younger, nobody asked police to be the judge, the jury, when you get arrested. So the way they deal with you is the biggest reason for the disconnect today. A lot of it is they're racist to me. A lot of them are racist. And not just white, black ones too. Myself, actually, I've had most bad experience with black officers. So to me, they're racist too, the same way. But the other problem you're going to always have when they all hold accountable, when one police sees another police doing wrong, then that's why you're all treated one way. The good old boy system. So as long as that goes on, and like most of the police, they do, to me, they're just doing it for a job, but nobody asked them to do that. So whether it's Freddie Gray or now, and whether it's a father in the house, if all you keep doing is locking people up and don't have no solutions when they get out, other than you're out and you're on an ankle pass or whatever, and you're supposed to work at McDonald's, and you're 30 and have a child at home, that's the bigger problem in the city. And you can blame the mayor, the governor, but to me, when you're talking about the governor, yeah, most of our governors just don't have a reality of what Baltimore, and that's the bigger problem, too.
Eric, appreciate your thinking and thoughts. I'm glad you waited to get on the air with us. I just thought a stat here that my producer sent over just for us to wrestle with on another day when we can really do this. There are at least four countries that have higher rates of birth to unmarried women than America. Do you know what they are?
No.
Anybody know what they are?
I feel like Norway is one of them.
Netherlands, France, Sweden, Denmark, and Norway.
I'm not surprised France is in there.
I wasn't surprised France was
stable societies with stable families, 410-319-8888. Melvin, you're on the air.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call. I want to say that the main thing that we need to look at is we're going to have to create a bill that actually changes the minimum wage as it relates to the GNP and the economic factors. We're going to have to present it to Congress ourselves and stand behind it so that we and get a livable wage, and that it doesn't just change on the whims of somebody's emotional feelings. If they're concerned about business not being able to support it, then they can support the business's payroll for a certain amount of time because that money's going to come back. People are going to buy goods and services. And until we correct that, that has, that's related to the homelessness, the people out on the streets selling drugs. Because you don't have affordable jobs. You don't have jobs where you can make your income.
Okay.
Being able to support your living. And the other thing I wanted to say was regarding the transportation. Why spend billions of dollars for a new red line when you don't have buses that can come on time, that they don't come frequently enough to get people to the jobs now, right now? You have a system, you have a subway system that only goes east and west. Why not expand upon that so people can be able to get into the city? I mean, people living over in the west have to come all the way downtown to State Center to get on a light rail just to go to Hunt Valley. That's 2 hours, 2.5 hours each
right.
way. That's 5 hours out of a day. How can somebody sustain, their life when they're spending 5 hours
right.
to get back and forth to their job?
Melvin, I appreciate the call. No, you're absolutely right. And I think that the issues you raise are really important. I'm going to have some final thoughts here from our panelists in a few minutes. But I think that and people can wax themselves agree or disagree, but I think you have Republicans who hate public transit and don't want to put any money into public transportation systems in our society. You have Democrats who don't know how to develop one to make it work right. And so between those two, nothing happens.
A perfect match.
A perfect match. And I think you're right. I mean, a subway system that went from east to west, that hit the subway system and could begin to build, as opposed to this. The Red Line, I've done a dozen shows on the Red Line over the last several years, and there were a lot of flaws people can't not addressing. And the fact that we don't have buses that are clean driving buses that are in this city and spending money on those and operating them on time so people can get to where they want to go and need to go. I mean, we're not thinking through transportation at all.
But I think it's on both sides, Democrats and Republicans, doing nothing about the issue. And I think at the heart of it is because we don't focus on the individuals that actually do partake in the public transportation
right.
system, and that their class issues very much tied to that. And because it is a largely particular class of individuals who are utilizing the system, we aren't willing to invest in it and make sure that they have the necessities to thrive and get to their jobs.
It's not just class, but also we've always, for whatever reason, we've governed and legislated around a tourism model. And so you see the circulator and you see public transportation easily and readily accessible in our tourist areas, regardless of which populations go underserved. Because quite frankly, it's no easier to catch a bus in Roland Park or Guilford than it is in Sandtown.
But that's class, though, because you're making the assumption that the folks
that
in Roland Park can do that. They have the necessity and ability.
I'm saying that they can't catch the bus any easier on time.
Right, but I'm saying
it's
they have the ability
downtown.
To use what resources they already have to get to downtown, where someone in Sandtown
right.
actually needs the
I'm
transportation.
I'm sure that there are plenty who and other class levels that would love if the public transportation system
absolutely.
Worked to use it to go to
O's,
games, and things.
But 35% of people in Baltimore don't have automobiles.
I'm one of them. Uber.
And not everybody can afford an Uber.
Right.
Well, let me just say my final word is I think that the Hogan administration made a reasonable compromise, getting rid of the red line, getting investment in the purple line. And I think Hogan has also given $350 million in road repairs to Baltimore City, and I think we have a serious governor who's making serious difficult decisions, and I think he's making wise decisions.
So this is a quick call, and then we'll go to our next segment on the United Nations Refugee Organization and what's happening in Syria and in Gaza with Palestinian refugees. We'll be talking about that coming up in the next segment. Let's go to Shannon for a quick thought on line four, then closing thoughts, and we'll jump out of here. Shannon, you're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, yes. Thanks for taking my call, and good morning.
Good morning.
I'd just like to say, basically, that I think it's a pretty good turnaround that finally the politicians, or rather the people in power in the city, are getting away from the tactic or the tradition, rather, of defending the police or closing ranks with the police when something happens, because the first real experience that I've had with regard to police altercations was in 1987 when my brother was killed at the hands of the Baltimore City Police. That's arguable. But his name was Jared Clayton. And when that happened, the prosecuting attorney, the prosecutor that was in charge of was Kerry Smoke himself. And he launched an investigation and 2 days later came back and defended all of the police for what they did. And the things that they did in that situation were terrible. And it was too much stuff to mention on the air right now. But
right.
I think that as a in contrast to that, I think that it's pretty good that the mayor's office is getting away from that from doing that, because if a police is bad, he needs to get off of the force. And if there's something questionable about their tactics, then there should be it should be addressed. It should always be transparency and you know, if they need to be prosecuted, they need to be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, because they are supposed to be the examples of the law.
Shannon, thank you so much. So this was a really fascinating discussion. I mean, intense but good, which I think as it should be. I'm sorry that I got a little too vociferous on that for you,
no,
Rick, at the very
no,
top.
No, you're fine, Mark. You're my bud.
But I think that there's some issues here that are really important, which is why I throw out that stat about Northern European countries being way ahead of us in women having children and not being married, and the societies are pretty stable.
Because families can be constructed in whatever form.
That's why cultural analogies are always invalid.
We have the power to do that. But instead, we've created a system that says this is what marriage has to be and look like, or this is what families has to be and look like, and if you don't do it this way, then you are part of the problem. And I think that is the problem.
And in all those countries, there are systems of daycare centers. In all those countries, there are the rules that allow people to take off for 6 to 9 months to take care of their child after they're born.
All socialistic.
Amen to that. We could use a bit more of that in America. So.
Oh, God. Yikes.
That's right. Coming out the closet. So
I'm tweeting that.
Be careful now. So.
Dr. I knew we'd end on a moment of agreement.
Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Dr. Rick Vatz, Cat Bird, good to have you all here.
Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure. And I want to remind you, as we go to this break, on our way to this break, what am I reminding you? I guess I'll remind you when I come back from break, because I can't find the right paper. So I will remind you when I come. Oh, I do want to remind you this before we go to break, okay? It's important. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org. It's MeQ, Baltimore's credit union's banner. We'll be right back. Stay with us. On the way to break, we are hearing Set the Controls for the Heart of the Sun by Pink Floyd, their album Saucerful of Secrets, released in the state in 1968. We'll be right back.
Little by little, the night turns around.